Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spartan Life Radio, brought to you by Norfolk State University, home of the mighty Spartans. Spartan Life Radio was created with you in mind. It's your source for news and information about NSU matters, including students, faculty, staff, administrators, alumni, and the communities we serve.
If you've been watching the news lately, you probably have seen an unprecedented number of politicians declaring their run for the presidency, some 77 candidates to date, and the number is growing. Recent headlines, though, have had more or less a singular focus on billionaire Donald Trump, who has managed to polarize some with his tough talk on immigration reform, while at the same time garnering a 57% favorable rating among GOP voters. Some are even saying this dark horse candidate is a serious contender for the presidency. Today on Spartan Life Radio, we're talking with political experts to see if we can make heads or tails out of all the hype and to bring you up to speed on the race to the 2016 presidency. Thank you for joining us. I'm Michael Cotter, your host. Got a question about today's topic? Hit us up at 1-347-850-8515. That number again, 1-347-850-8515. Or you can press 1 on your telephone keypad if you want to speak to our guest. Just want to listen in? Just dial the number. Next up, your Spartan Life News Briefs.
Good afternoon, everyone. These are your Spartan Life News Briefs for the week ending July 17th. The National Science Foundation recently announced that NSU biology professor Dr. Ashley N. Haynes is the recipient of a $198,000 grant for support of a project that examines the how and why of bacteria's ability to adapt to their environment. Haynes said the bacteria have adapted to diverse environments ranging from human or animal hosts and to the depths of the oceans. The grant funds will be used for new equipment, lab supplies, year-long stipends for two students, sample analysis, and more. Don't forget that the 2015 AAU Junior Olympic Games is coming to NSU's Dick Price Stadium next month. The Hampton Roads Chamber of Commerce Sports Commission sponsors the event, which will be held August 1st through the 8th. About 15,000 youth athletes ages 7 through 17 from around the country will compete in 20 sporting events throughout the region. For more information, for a complete schedule of events, visit the AAU Junior Olympics website at www.aaujrogames.org. Andrew Heidelberg, member of the Norfolk 17 and former Norfolk State football player, passed away on July 6, just a few weeks before it was announced that he would be inducted into the Hampton Roads Sports Hall of Fame. Heidelberg was a standout offensive football player at Norfolk State College from 1962 to 65. After his playing career at NSU ended, Heidelberg went into the banking industry and later held positions in the city of Hampton's treasurer's office. He published a book in 2006 titled The Norfolk 17, A Perspective, a Personal Narrative on Desegregation in Norfolk, Virginia in 1958 through 1962. The Sports Hall of Fame induction ceremony will take place in October. Norfolk State has a new chief of police and public safety. Troy Covington was appointed to the position of NSU's top cop earlier this month. He is a 32-year law enforcement veteran. Covington also served in the military police force during his 10-year stint with the Army. Chief Covington begins his tenure with NSU on July 20th. And those are your Spartan Life News Briefs. You can visit us at www.nsu.edu for more news and events and other happenings on and off campus.
The U.S. presidential election is scheduled to be held November 8, 2016. With more than a year out, campaign contributions are soaring and are expected to grow. Campaigns and the campaigners are required to report their results with the Federal Election Commission by July 15th, which was yesterday. And while the deadline for the super PACs is July 31st, this is when we'll find out which campaigns have raked in the most money and we'll learn which donors have written the fattest checks to super PACs. But even more interesting is the number of candidates who have tossed their hats into the political arena. And at the top of the show, I mentioned some 77 candidates have declared their intentions to run for the presidency. Well, let's take a look at the numbers. There are 17 Democrats, 36 Republicans, and 24 independence. But the forerunners have distanced themselves from the pack, and some more than others are positioned, though precariously, on the national stage. On this episode of Spartan Life Radio, we have two of the country's best political analysts in the studio to help us cut through the clutter. Again, if you have a question or if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-347-850-8515. Our guests today are Dr. L.C. Barnes, who is the professor of political science at Norfolk State University in the Political Science Department, and Dr. Carol J. Pretlow, associate professor, also in the same department. Dr. Barnes has been a viable and significant presence at Norfolk State University since before Dr. Lyman Beecher Brooks retired. So she's been here since the 70s. I hate to put that out there, but that's the truth. Dr. Barnes has been quoted in various newspapers along the East Coast and has appeared on various television news programs providing blow-by-blow analysis during election night coverage. After leaving administrative positions at NSU, Dr. Barnes remains at the university and is teaching several political science classes. Also joining us today on Spartan Life Radio is Dr. Carol Pretlow, associate professor in NSU's Political Science Department. Dr. Pretlow is one of the hardest working women in academia today and often carries a class load of 4 or 5 courses. She juggles grant writing and special projects. Just a woman who wears many hats. She has edited several textbooks and has authored a couple of textbooks and is currently working on an article about the Obama administration for a major political magazine. I want to welcome both of you to Spartan Life Radio. I'm so glad to have both of you on the show today.
Well, thank you, Professor Carter.
Okay. Well, listeners, again, if you'd like to join the discussion or if you have a question, give us a call at area code 347-850-8515. Press 1 on your telephone keypad if you want to talk to our guests. And listen live at blogtalkradio.com/Spartan Life or via your telephone or other mobile device. First, we have questions in two sections, how consumers can protect themselves. From some of the stuff that we're hearing in the media, the kinds of questions that are coming at us. But we want to make sure that we are not being inundated with the wrong kinds of messages. And so I'm going to throw this out to both of you. Number one, with all the effort one has to endure to run for president, for the presidency, why do you think the field of candidates is so crowded? Let me just start with Dr. Barnes first.
Yes. Thank you, Mike. Well, I guess when you consider that the United States has a population of roughly 321 million residents, a couple of dozen or several dozen people aspiring to be president, maybe it's not a large number. However, traditionally, it is a large number. Generally, you have a few candidates who have been given the green light by the two dominant parties, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and a few other candidates from parties that run candidates but do not run them successfully, such as the Green Party or the Libertarian Party or the Constitutional Party. Now, what's different about this field of candidate? I think this field of candidates, if you look at them very closely, represents the heightened awareness of diversity in the American population. The American population has always been rather diverse, but that diverseness has not been articulated to the extent that it is articulated today. So you have all of these individuals who feel that they can carry the banner for these very diverse populations, and so they are just jumping into the presidential race. Now, of course, some of them will be taken more seriously than others, and others will fall into the category of always running. You know, every time a presidential election comes up, they will throw the hat in the ring And so they are just there. They don't get to participate in the major debates. They don't draw a lot of attention, if any attention, from the national media. In fact, a great many of them are unknown to the vast majority of the residents of the United States. So they just... I guess overall, if you weed out those, it's not a really large number.
Okay, and we're... I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dr. Barnes.
I was going to say I agree with Dr. Barnes totally. And she mentioned one thing about some of them are relatively unknown. Now, to me, and I'm not a psychologist, but I look at political ambition. Even if you don't win, at least I'm garnering name recognition. I'm getting my name out there. And next time around, I could have even more of a potential for succeeding. And even if I don't succeed for the presidency, I might get something else, maybe vice president, maybe another political appointment. So there are all kinds of reasons why people say, I'm going to throw my hat into the ring. And there are also a lot of reasons for them being eliminated.
Well, I'm wondering if this may have a reverse effect of what I think some of these candidates are hoping to achieve, that by having so many names in the hat, it just confuses voters even more so. I mean, you know, I have a very easy time of choosing the suit I want to wear when I only have four or five. But when I have 15, it may take me a little bit longer to make that decision. I'm wondering, and I know it's a much more complicated process than suit choosing, but I am wondering if we are diluting this whole pool of candidates in terms of the choices that we can make because we can focus on some of the issues, some of the hardcore issues with the candidates who I said at the top of the show are really the forerunners. Your thoughts on that?
Well, Mike, I think it's important to note here that at this stage in the game, most people aren't paying attention.
Mm.
Most
That's
people
true.
Won't weigh in until 2016, and 2016 closer to November than 2016 January. So the people who are paying attention now are people who generally get paid to pay attention, the media type individuals, and the party leaders who are saying, wait a minute, we got to weed some of these people out. How are we going to weed them out before they damage the party brand? So as far as John Doe voter is concerned, John Doe voter isn't paying attention generally at this point in time.
Okay.
No, and I agree, and I don't think they're taking a lot of these people seriously. They're looking at it as almost political drama, you know. Oh, did you hear what the funny thing so-and-so said on TV?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not really serious. They're not thinking, okay, this is the person I have a potential for voting for. It's just political theater.
Well, you know,
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
When you look at someone like Donald Trump, who's labeled in many camps as a dark horse, you have to remember that he has the wherewithal, the resources to garner the attention that will get him attention in the media. And whether you are a fan of Mr. Trump or not, he has a knack for sound bites that capture the attention of the media.
Well, we're gonna deal with Mr. Trump in a minute because he has an interesting take on things, and like I said, he has managed to polarize and galvanize at the same time, and it's an interesting way to actually get out there with this brash and bold voice to the presidential race. But I wanted to just say something first about Fox News because they're picking a presidential nominee or the nominees early, and it's projected that they can determine who will get to debate and who will not. What do you make of this kind of foray, if you will, into the people that are going to be staged and those who are kind of be left behind? Do you think that's a good process?
Well, I think it's an interesting process, and I'm glad you mentioned, because the New York Times on Friday did an article about this very thing, the impact of the media and broadcast organizations specifically on candidate selections. And the whole idea of Fox News or CNN saying they're going to limit themselves to two major debates, that kind of has an impact too, because that means, okay, I'm going to garner the people who are really interested to look at me. I'm going to figure out, you know, what to say, how to say it. And so it becomes, well, I think the New York Times said, a hunger game. It's, okay, I'm out there. I'm going to say the most insightful things. I'm going to try to garner the public that way. So it becomes a media game as well.
Well, I think also at this point for networks like Fox News to be saying we are going to do this and that, it sort of truncates the filtering process. It short circuits getting to know candidates that will be viable candidates if given enough time. They have some filters in place that say if you don't get 10% of the public opinion polls at XYZ time that you will not be considered for the vote. In other words, they're taking the top 10.
Right.
So this sort of eliminates a serious candidate that is struggling to get his sea legs under him or her.
But it also cuts out those who do not have the deep pockets to launch a really viable campaign.
Well, you know, I think you're right about that. And, in fact, I'm trying to remember when money didn't determine who was going to be the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I was in elementary school then, and I'm 68, so, you know, that was a long time ago. Because it's all about the money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who can raise money? And when you're talking about people making raising millions of dollars for a campaign.
Carol, I want to jump in here. I think money is very, very important in a campaign, but I would stop a little short of inferring that candidates can buy a campaign if they have enough money. And I know that's not what you were saying. You were putting the significance of money front and center, and it is. If you are a candidate at this time, you cannot launch a serious campaign without money. But there have been candidates who have had significant financial backing, and they have not been successful.
Well, that's true, too. So it's not all about money. A lot of it's about money, but it's not all about it. So.
Yeah, it's a lot about money, though. Obviously, with the cost of media time and all of that, you cannot run a campaign today without having financial resources.
Well, if we listen to the likes of Donald Trump, a declaration of what his net worth is something that's, you know, been in the headlines and it's making the news, and the sound bites are all there because that's something he prides himself on, because he feels that he can distance himself from the pack because of his deep pockets. But I want to take this in a different direction, if I can, just a little bit, and just ask this question. Could the number of candidates reflect how the political parties feel about the Obama administration?
That's a good question.
Go ahead, Carol. Okay, let me take a stab at this. I think that the Obama administration is a lightning rod for a number of hot button issues, particularly those that determine the direction of policy in areas such as same-sex marriage, health care, and recently announced revamping the criminal justice system and what have you. So, yes, in that sense, I think it does Mm-hmm. And if you would look at those 77 candidates that you mentioned, it's sort of lopsided on having many more Republican aspirants mm-hmm. than Democratic aspirants. Mm-hmm. So I think there is some sense a connection there.
Okay. Dr. Perlo?
Well, I agree with Dr. Barnes. I also, again, don't discount the idea that they are getting their names and faces out there, and even if they aren't successful in getting the nomination, at least people say, "Whoa, I know that person." Well, case in point, Bobby Jindal. I mean, who knew him mm-hmm. before the last presidential election? And, okay, here he was out there. He was not making a significant contribution. But now we see the face and we say, oh, yeah, know him. And there are some others. Now, whether that will materialize or segue into a predominant contribution in the next administration, who knows, but at least there is name recognition. They're getting the start for that.
Well, I think there's something to that process, and certainly there are some names that have been floating from the last election that are starting to resurface, you know, names like Howard Dean. Even there's some talk about Michael Bennett. We might see the likes of Al Franken, Alan Grayson. There are a number of people who are potential candidates, some who have not declared yet. And even we're asking the question if Joe Biden will toss his hat into the ring, which will certainly make it a much more interesting race. Can we explain how the process of how the field of candidates will get a little bit thinner? And I know some of this is attrition, you know, whether you have the money to stage a successful campaign or whether Fox News gets its way and picks the top 10 candidates for the debates. What are some of the other ways we might see this field thinning out?
Well, I think one of the things that we cannot discount, and that is the point that Carol was making about money, mm-hmm. Some of them are simply going to run out of money before they run out of steam. And when you don't have money, you can't buy steam. But also in this crowded field, as they go to Iowa, New Hampshire, and places like that, they're going to show so poorly that their support financially and otherwise will begin to shift to other more viable candidates. So that will leave them out. And then some others will bow to pressure of the national parties, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, and say, well, I'll step aside. I don't want this to become a situation where in trying to get my party's nomination, I'm going to provide fuel for the opposing party. So rather than do that in the interest of the national party, I'll just step aside. So those are just a few of the ways that the field will be trimmed down.
Okay. I'm looking at the structure, if you will, of the voting process, and I'm trying to figure out why we're still using the Electoral College the way that we've been using it forever. Is there something that we can do differently to help determine the outcome of the elections?
Well, I think there's some limitations on this, and Dr. Barnes is more an expert on this than I would be, but it goes back to the founding of our country and the determination of the Electoral College, that there be an Electoral College. Now, should we change from the Electoral College system, it's not just as simple as saying, okay, we're going to do this, it would have to be go through the process of states and their being a determination in each of the states, and then a determination on the federal level, and the law exactly for the electoral process would have to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the founding fathers established the Electoral College as a process in the Constitution. It was a compromise then between election of the president by a vote of Congress and election of the president by a popular vote of qualified citizens. And we do know that at that time, the persons eligible to vote was not as expansive as it is today. So the Electoral College is a process that has to be changed through the constitutional process. Mm-hmm. And people are creatures of habit. And if one side determines that it's going to be disadvantageous to them to change the process, they are not going to support any mm-hmm. change in the process. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the distribution of the population in the United States and divvy that up into what we refer to as blue states and red states, in other words, Republican states and Democratic states, both sides can see reasons why, okay, this Electoral College is not good, but how's it going to work for us if we change it to a strictly popular vote process?
And every time we have these elections, and particularly in the national arena, there's always a question about whether we're having a clean election, and we always come back to this question about why we're still using the Electoral College. But you're saying that this has to be a matter of constitutional law in order to impact mm-hmm. the way we do business in America.
See, the founding fathers really had. They were establishing a Republican form of government, and some people equate that to a full-fledged democracy of the people, for the people, by the people, et cetera, et cetera. But the founding fathers very narrowly looked at the American population, and when they looked at the American population, it was not for all of the people, by all of the people, for all of the people. So to ensure that there was some buffer between the masses and the so-called leadership, the people who possess the wherewithal to govern everybody else, they put this Electoral College in place.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's not perfect, it benefits political leaders in ways that will not garner a lot of support for change. Because as you recall now, the electors, when they get to cast their votes, they aren't required by the Constitution to cast their vote for the candidate they were selected to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to do that. And occasionally you will have a rogue elector who will not vote for the person that the elector was designated to vote for. So this process, and it is a process, could really get out of hand if you had a significant number of electors deviating from the tradition that they vote for the presidential candidate that they were chosen as an elector for. The rogue electors that have deviated, they've not been in significant numbers enough to change the outcome of the election.
And that certainly can have some consequences for candidates who are multicultural. We may have Hispanic candidates or female candidates or African-American candidates who may find themselves isolated in that process if you do, in fact, have these rogue electors who decide to go their own route.
That's quite true.
Is certainly true.
Yes.
But you have to remember, too, how the electors are selected. Usually getting to be an elector is a reward for laboring loyally for the party. And the election process, the selection process for electors certainly varies by state law, but many of the instances it's a reward for working for the party and party loyalty.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I just want to say, listeners, if you'd like to join the discussion or if you have a question, please give us a call. Again, our number is 347-850-8515. You can press 1 on your telephone keypad if you want to talk to our guests. And you can listen live, again, at blogtalkradio.com/Spartan Life or via your telephone or other mobile device. Let me just ask Dr. Pretlow, what kind of impact, if any, and I'm switching gears again, and I'll do that. That's what I've been known to do. But what kind of impact, if any, do you think that a midterm election could have on a presidential race, a senatorial race, or a gubernatorial race?
Well, you know, I'm a basic kind of analyst, and I say that it gets the name out there, and then it gives a feel of who has potential for riding it out. But basically, I think it has more of an impact on legislation that is going before Congress. For example, when you're looking at the House race or the senatorial race, the whole idea is if you are a close watcher, I'm going to see what this pans out to be, because this may have an impact on what legislation gets passed. And even if my person, the person I selected, got to be president, if his party is not a dominant party in either the House or the Senate, it might be rough going for him.
So would you like to see a midterm election? Do you think that would be a good process for us?
I don't know. I think what it would mean would be an encouragement of a lot more money being spent in the electoral process. And I have problems with that. I just see this as a consumer base. Well, in fact, last week I heard the phrase retail politics. Okay. That says something not very attractive about the electoral process to me.
Okay.
Well, Mike, I think the midterm election process is a contribution to the psychic of the political parties. The midterm election is just an election that's held midpoint between the last presidential election and the next presidential election. So if a political party who is in charge of the House or the Senate, if they can maintain that leadership, then it is a boost to their psyche. If they lose, obviously, it makes them say, well, wait, what went wrong? And particularly if they lose badly, if they lose in large enough numbers to change the dynamics of policy making in the United States Congress, and even if it creates a logjam, I think the impact is more on the psychic of the political parties, and it emboldens the leadership of the winning party to push forward with maybe some unpopular initiatives. Maybe they try to derail initiatives that they would not try to derail if it had not been for success at the midterm election point. So I think it has a large psychological element to it. And plus, it's a barometer of where the public is going, where the public is thinking, with the understanding now that not all people who converge on the midterm elections bring the same mentality to national elections, because you have people who will vote in a national election during presidential election year, and they devalue their contribution in terms of midterm elections, so they simply stay home.
That's one thing that I think that we all do with our students is we talk to them about general elections and how important it is to vote for senators and in those in the House and to make sure that the president of your choice gets the support that he or she will need and how important those elections are. So many people just do the national elections. But I think the midterm elections might be an excellent gauge on one hand, just to see the direction the country is moving in and to see what's important to Americans in terms of the issues. And on the other hand, it perhaps could have a negative effect on those who are running because they actually see how far behind in the polls they actually are and just how little support they are going to get when the time for the national election takes place. I would be remiss, of course, and we've mentioned this a little bit, and we certainly have to talk about the Donald. He has garnered at least 57% of GOP voters. They have a favorable view of him. That's according to MSNBC today. And he says things, and I think, Dr. Barnes, you said a little bit about that, the sound bites that get people talking, and it doesn't matter how incendiary those comments are. People are talking about what he's saying. He calls the leadership of America stupid. And so we're not getting those fully developed, coherent sentences, but fragmented, sometimes laughable streams of consciousness that actually resonate with GOP supporters. What do you think about Donald Trump's chances in this election?
Well, I think what any politician remembers is that the public's affection is fleeting. And November 2016, is certainly a long way away. So just because he's playing to a particular element of the Republican Party, it does not mean that that will be sufficient to carry him over. And one thing that I have observed about Mr. Trump is that he's equal opportunity in the sense that he's almost guaranteed to say something to offend everyone every week. So whether he will do that this time around remains to be seen, but he has already racked up a number of groups that he has offended. And given his self-concept and his public opinion poll numbers, I think he will just go on and do what he usually does well, and that is to self-destruct politically.
Dr. Pretlow, do you think he has a point about immigration reform? Do you think his comments are off the mark, or do you think he's on point?
No, I disagree fervently with him. But I think this. I do think there needs to be reform, but I think it has to be well thought out, and I think that it should not be just, okay, we're targeting any particular group, but in light of what we have on our Statue of Liberty, let's look at how we can make the process, refine the whole process. Yes, we want to encourage people to come into the country. Yes, we want to look at what makes them good candidates for residing here and contributing to our society. But I don't think it should be a soundbite. I think it's a process, and I think that process needs to be adhered to, and it should not be just a gut instinct, or I'm going to close the borders and keep all the people from coming in that I don't want. No, I don't think that.
But, you know, what happened just recently in San Francisco, and Dr. Burns, I'll give you a chance to respond to that, what happened recently in San Francisco with the stabbing and then again with El Chapo, you know, I don't know whether these things are just happening at the, you know, a convenient time for him or an opportune time for him to just kind of latch on to this and make his point. But this seems to resonate with a lot of people when they take a look at Mexican authority. They look at the people who are actually in the country. I don't necessarily agree. I'm playing the devil's advocate. I'm simply saying, does he have a point?
Well, Mike, I think we should not be too dismissive of what Mr. Trump is saying. I think what gets him into a great deal of turmoil is how he says it,
mm-hmm.
and where he says it, and when he says it. Because he is articulating the views of people. I mean, they may not be the majority, but some people support him on what he is saying. And I think what you see here in play is sort of a Machiavellian impact. People who have power want to keep it. People who don't have power try to get it. And if we look at the direction or the trajectory of the ethnic population in the United States, in our lifetime, well, maybe not mine because I'm sort of old, but you can certainly see where the white male will certainly be a minority on a number of fronts. And you're going to see, well, you've already seen this in states like California, Arizona, where the Hispanic population is of growing influence. And see, you're in a nation state of diverse ethnic groups, but you're also in a nation state where the traditional power base has been with the Caucasian male. And you are going to find that there are a number of sensibilities to that eroding power base. And Mr. Trump is playing to that base.
And I must
mean,
add,
he may not be doing it for nefarious reasons, but he's doing it nonetheless. You'll have people agreeing with Mr. Trump, but for different reasons.
Not the least of which is Ted Cruz, who obviously he met with Donald Trump. He echoes his support for his stance on immigration. And some people are saying that, well, maybe this is, and this is the senator from Texas, maybe he is mm-hmm. drafting and that term is being pulled in Trump's wake, that he's hitching his wagon to this rising star, so to speak. What do you think about that?
Wait, I'm not clear on what you're saying, that Mr. Trump is trying to hitch his wagon?
No. Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas.
Well, I think that's a slippery slope. He should be very careful in trying to hitch his wagon to anything that Mr. Trump does, because Mr. Trump is he's a very self-centered individual. So I don't see him wanting to share the limelight a great deal. It may work for Mr. Cruz, but I doubt it.
Well, you know, I think we can't argue with the numbers, and you're right. Maybe this is a short-term popularity that he's experiencing right now, but he is surging in the polls. He's leading Republicans in terms of his viability and visibility and acceptance by GOP supporters. So I don't know if he's doing something right, but he's doing something to at least get people to pay attention.
Can I throw a question?
Sure.
Yeah, because, you know, every time I see Donald Trump, I wonder, is he serious? I mean, does he really think he's going to get the Republican nomination?
Well, Carol, I think Mr. Trump is always serious, because if you look at his biography, anything that he goes in to win. So I see no reason why he would go into this not expecting to win. Now, will he win? That's a different story. But does he want to win? Yes.
Well,
can he win is a different question.
Can he win
is a different question. And, you know, he makes statements like the working class and middle class Americans have not been served, or they're under underserved by this president, and he is the answer that America has been looking for. He has the tough rhetoric. He speaks to the things that people can't say in polite company, and these are the aspirations of those who remain silent, that he is perhaps articulating what people can't say because it's not politically correct. And here he just says whatever comes to mind. That resonates with some people, whether we like it or not. Some people like it.
Yeah, but when you look at the people that it doesn't resonate with, those same people, for example, African Americans, Latino Americans, the people who made a difference in the last two elections, then he's turning them off. So
okay, Carol, let me jump into here. This is one thing about all this this varied field of candidates. I would, Mr. Trump has some African American supporters, and he has some Latino supporters.
Well, he does have some, but in the past week or two, I've been looking, you know, at CNN and at different media sources, and MSNBC, and there are people from the Latino community and the African-American community who are coming on and speaking out against his particular statements, in fact, the statements that he made about immigration. And so
now, those
I'm,
are the opinion leaders for these groups, and that's an area that we have not covered, Mike. How do people really decide to cast their votes? And many people don't have time or the desire to wade through all of the issues, to look at where this candidate stands on A, where the candidate stands on B, C, D, E, F, and on down the line. So what they do is they look to their opinion leaders, and their opinion leaders could be their minister, it could be their current mayor, it could be any number of people. It could be their spouse. And so they don't wade through all the issues. They just ask significant opinion leaders, whomever they might be, for whom should I vote? And that's the way they cast their ballot. So candidates who are good at capturing the support of opinion leaders can garner a votes, significant numbers of votes that way.
That's an excellent, excellent point. Let's switch gears again. Let's talk about former U.S. Senator Jim Webb from Virginia. Any clue as to why he thinks he can run a successful presidential campaign?
I'll doubt on that discussion because I have no clue.
Mr. Webb is a very methodical individual. He's highly organized. He thinks things through very well, and some people would probably say he thinks too much. He weighs this against that, and he can come up with a well-organized, reasonable analysis of any number of issues that you come across. But also part of being a successful candidate is establishing that connection, that human connection between the voter and the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if he is
That's
to fall
point.
Short, he is to fall short there. Some people might call it that charisma.
Yeah.
He is highly intelligent.
Yeah.
If you were to put that as your number one factor, he would certainly be a very formidable opponent. But people connect to candidates in different ways, and that personal connection, I think, will put that intellectual trait a bit more down the line, down the list of why people vote for candidates.
Well,
so
I certainly think that even before the election of Barack Obama, you know, I don't necessarily think that was a high priority in the previous election. But, you know, people pick presidents for reasons that are special or connected to them or to their issues. I would like to think that people are in fact listening to the issues and that we're not just getting attached to personalities.
But,
Dr. Pretlow?
Yeah, I would agree with both you and Dr. Barnes, but again, here's that phrase, retail politics, and do this, say that. And I agree with you, Dr. Barnes. He is very intelligent, very articulate, his analysis is on point, but it's something about him that doesn't resonate with the public.
He's not particularly warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, maybe
whatever that means.
Well, I don't know if that makes for the best resume point that we want to take a look at when we're trying to pick
Bill
a president.
Clinton in comparison.
Well, you certainly can't put that on your official resume. Hey, look, I'm warm and fuzzy. But when people start making psychological connections
mm-hmm.
to you,
mm-hmm.
They look for those human elements that say, hey, this person is like me, or this person is an advocate for me, so I want to vote for this person.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, the one person who seems to be doing a pretty good job on the Democratic side is Bernie Sanders. I think he's giving Hillary Clinton a run for her money. What makes him so special in the voters' minds?
Well, Bernie Sanders, I think, is a very good left-wing candidate. But for the general election, you're going to have to move to the center. And I don't think Bernie Sanders is capable of doing that.
Okay. Let me ask you this. What is a perennial candidate? We hear that all the time, and I know sometimes our viewers are like, what is perennial, annual, what's going on? What's a perennial candidate?
Well, now here's just my interpretation. I think of it as someone who is always running, always election after election. They don't have, I can't say the word, a chance, a very good chance of being nominated either by their party, but they always are out there. They're always throwing their name in the ring. I think there are people who just like the publicity of saying, I ran for president.
And Carol is absolutely correct. It's someone who runs every presidential election year. I think they just like being out there. One candidate comes to mind on the Democratic side, Willie Carter. He's a small businessman. I'm trying to remember where he's from. I can't think of where he's from right now. But he's been running since 1988, I believe. and he just runs.
Okay, this is Willie Carter, you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm trying to think about where he's from now. I can't think of it right now, but he runs every presidential election year.
Okay, I think I have a little bit of information about Willie Carter. I'll get to it in a minute. I do want to ask this next question, though, and this has to do with the opinion polls and if people should actually be listening to these polls, because I think sometimes we think that it gives the candidate legitimacy if he's being featured in a major poll. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I disagree, because a poll is not a series of questions to specific groups of people, and it's a numbers game. So they're just reporting what they have researched. Now, certainly we are familiar with the Pew poll and Gallup and some of the others more so than, but they're just supposed to be a reflection of the demographics that they have researched. And I don't know about them being a kind operating as a legitimacy for a candidate.
Well, when you mention opinion polls to me, I almost always think of the people who are asked questions about things that don't exist And they say, oh, yeah, yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I like that person. I think I'll vote for that person. And the person doesn't exist. So I think you have to be very careful, even though politicians all the time use those results out in their speeches and in their literature and what have you. What they do is they make those numbers give them some type of legitimacy, even though it might be unfounded legitimacy.
Well, what do they say? You know, people quote statistics in the absence of facts, so I guess we have to be careful with that, right?
I like that.
Yes.
Willie Cotter is from Texas, by the way,
okay.
But he's in Los Angeles, and he's a small business owner, deacon, and Sunday school superintendent. So, yeah, he's been out there for a while. He's 72 years old, by the way.
Cool.
Yeah, and
okay.
I just think he likes running.
Okay.
Let me ask you this one last question. Actually, I've got one or two last questions, and we'll see how much time we have left. What should voters actually be looking for as they pick their candidate? And I know sometimes we tend to focus on the hot button issues, you know, whether it's gay marriage or whether it's abortion or whether it's immigration. What kinds of things should people be listening for when they look at their candidates?
Well, Mike, I tell my students all of the time, vote your own interests. So I cannot decide what's important to you, and you cannot decide what's important to me. You have to do that for yourself. And once you do that, those things that are important to you, you have to identify the candidate that best articulates your views on those two, three, four major things that are important to you, because you're not going to get everything you want in one candidate.
That's true. I don't think I have much to add to that other than I tell my students to look at the issues, look at the pros and cons of the issue, and divide it up into the different categories, economic, social, political, legal, and then make a decision as to what they think the perspective should be and to identify the candidate that fits that perspective. So that's it. The selection of a candidate or decision is highly personalized.
Absolutely. I think we've only touched the tip of the iceberg in our discussion today. We are nearing the end of this episode, but I certainly want to thank both of you, Dr. Barnes, Dr. Pretlow, for taking time out to join us today. This has been an informed discussion. I like this. And I think that the voters get something from this, too. The 2016 presidential campaign may be one for the record books. We don't know just yet, but I think there's going to be a little bit more coming at us that will present a few surprises. Again, thank you both for joining us on this issue of Spartan Life Radio.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I want to just say join us for the next episode of Spartan Life Radio Thursday, July 30th at 1 p.m. for a talk about Norfolk State's Honors College. Joining us will be Dr. Paige Laws. You won't want to miss that. For a complete list of upcoming Spartan Life Radio shows, please visit blogtalkradio.com/Spartan Life. Or you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Listen to this broadcast or others on demand at www.blogtalkradio.com/Spartan Life Radio. It's been an interesting discussion today. We've opened up a little bit about some of the candidates, who they are, but there are many, many more. You certainly want to be an informed voter, and so you want to arm yourself with the information that will make your decision the right one, at least for you. This is not about who's the most popular, but who has the answers that you're looking for, the questions that you have. Whether you're voting as an independent or Republican or as a Democrat, you certainly want to make an informed decision. All of us have challenges when it comes to the country and the issues that are facing us, whether we're talking about nuclear proliferation, what's happening in the Middle East, and whether the correct answers have been given to resolve some of those issues. We are looking at politics, but we're also looking at humanitarian efforts to make sure that we live in a safer world. And whether we criticize our president for the decisions that have been made or whether we support him. We all have an opinion, and perhaps we need to have that opinion articulated through some of the representatives that we choose. That's what happens in those general elections. So I want to encourage everybody, please make sure that you vote. John F. Kennedy once said, "Let us not seek the Republican answer or the Democratic answer, but the right answer. Let us not seek to fix the blame for the past. Let us accept our own responsibility for the future." I think he was on to something. I'm Michael Cotter, and you have been listening to Spartan Life Radio from the inside out. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Spartan Life Radio. Tune in bi-weekly on Thursday afternoons for another new episode of Spartan Life. For more information on Norfolk State University, visit nsu.edu or check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and Flickr.